And let's get started with what's going on between Israel and Hezbollah. Last time we talked, there were some sort of pager bombing, walkie-talkie bombings. Right now we have fighter jets bombing the southern part of Lebanon, and Netanyahu trying to send a video message, which is the same that he has sent to Gazans. If you remember, in those days he said that Hamas is your enemy. We are not your enemy. We are not going to kill you. It's Hamas that is killing you. And right now he's just sending the same sort of message, Scott. Here is his...
People of Lebanon, Israel's war is not with you. It's with Hezbollah. For too long, Hezbollah has been using you as human shields. It placed rockets in your living rooms and missiles in your garage. Those rockets and missiles are aimed directly at our cities, directly at our citizens. To defend our people against Hezbollah strikes, we must take out those weapons. Now, starting this morning, the IDF has warned you to get out of harm's way. I urge you, take this warning seriously. Don't let Hezbollah endanger your lives and the lives of your loved ones. Don't let Hezbollah endanger Lebanon. Please, get out of harm's way now. Once our operation is finished, you can come back safely to your homes.
Yeah, if you replace Hezbollah with Hamas, it's the same kind of rhetoric.
Run back safely to your homes if we haven't blown them up, because we don't know what the hell we're doing, and we're targeting everything indiscriminately based upon generic intelligence, pure guesswork. He can say what he wants. First of all, the idea that Hezbollah and Lebanon are two distinct entities is ludicrous. Hezbollah is a political party, not just a militia movement, not just a political movement, but a political party, part of the Lebanese government, an important part of the Lebanese government. Hezbollah is Lebanon, and Lebanon is Hezbollah. That's the new reality, one that Netanyahu and the Israelis clearly haven't grasped. The other thing, your entire statement opening up focused solely on Israel's strikes against Lebanon. War is a two-way street, buddy. Lebanon, Hezbollah, is striking Israel. And this is the important fact, because the... besides my dogs taking umbrage at what I'm saying there, this is the danger of buying a puppy. He just decides to bark whenever he wants to. And right now they're chasing a cat around the floor.
Maybe someone is at the door.
It is what it is. But, Hezbollah is striking back at Israel. And this is the important thing. You see, this war is an extension of politics by other means. That's just a standard truism that Sun Tzu and Clausewitz and every military philosopher has acknowledged. You can't treat the military objectives separate from the political objectives, because the military objectives are designed to achieve the political objectives. Netanyahu has stated his political objectives. That is to return the 60,000 settlers who have been displaced from their homes back to their homes. In order to do that, he says he must defeat Hezbollah. Well, good luck. You tried that in 2006, you being Israel, and it didn't work. You couldn't stop Hezbollah from firing rockets into Israel. And in the end, Israel had to face a humiliating step down from their objectives of destroying Hezbollah. Well, he's done it again. All Hezbollah has to do to win is continue to fire rockets into northern Israel to ensure that the 60,000 settlers who have left their homes can't return home. And that's what's happening. But Hezbollah is also expanding the scope and scale of its strikes. So it's more than likely that tens of thousands of additional Israelis will be compelled to leave their homes, because Hezbollah is now striking targets in the Galilee and near Haifa. And Israel can't stop this. They can't defeat it. Hezbollah has been preparing for this conflict ever since 2006. The conflict ended. They're not stupid. They know what Israel can do. They've been aware of the weapon system Israel has procured. They fully anticipate this. There's nothing that Israel's doing right now that takes Hezbollah by surprise, other than the pager attack, which was an act of terrorism, which Hezbollah has adapted to. Israel now is apparently flooding the Bekaa Valley and other parts of Lebanon with leaflets that have a barcode or a QR code. And I guess in hopes that the the person who receives it will get curious about it and click it on. Apparently it activates some sort of mechanism that drains, identifies the phone, drains the, because when you click on a QR code, you're linking yourself to a site, and that's run by Unit 8200, which will immediately infect your phone, drain the data, and then target you for death. Again, terrorism, because what happens if a kid picks it up and does it? What happens if a nurse, a doctor, somebody innocent picks it up and does it? You know, it's just part and parcel of the Israeli approach to this conflict, which is to be in total disregard for human life and for the laws of war.
And do you think to what extent they're willing to risk a conflict with Hezbollah? Do you think they're going to put troops on the ground if something goes wrong in that direction?
I mean, this morning, Israel indicated it was mobilizing two reserve brigades for duty in the north. What that means, we don't know. I can say this, Israel does not have the military capacity to push Hezbollah out of southern Lebanon, north of the Litani River. That's always been a stated military objective of Israel. They lack the capacity to do that. They lack the capacity when their military was intact, but now their military has been fighting for a year. Any forces that are being mobilized, any forces that exist are exhausted by this conflict, have suffered casualties, have suffered material losses, and have seen the morale of their troops plummet. They can't, I can guarantee you this, short of a few special forces units, and even those, I would imagine, have changed their attitude towards this conflict. There's no Israeli force that's saying, I want to go into southern Lebanon. They know that it's a death trap, suicide rap. Don't go in there. It's the same approach they have towards Gaza. There's no Israeli unit other than a handful of special forces units that are saying, I want to go into Gaza. I'm ready for it. They've been to Gaza. They're all dying. They've all been wounded. They recognize the futility of the operation. And so there's a lot of political posturing by Netanyahu, but his war cabinet has rejected his demands for increased military operation. United States has said, no, we're not going to facilitate this. So we'll see. I think a lot of what Netanyahu does is domestic political posturing, designed to create the impression of action when in fact the action is impossible to undertake. We're going to strike Iran. No, you're not. We're going to go to war against Hezbollah. No, you're expanding operations, but it's a carefully managed game of escalation that's taking place right now. That doesn't mean that it can't spin out of control. That doesn't mean that there can't be a miscalculation or a misjudgment. But right now, I think there's more posturing than actual preparation for a full-scale conflict with Hezbollah.
Do you think the reason behind this new wave of tensions is because of these Israelis, that they won't send them to the northern part of Israel, or something else?
Say that one more time.
The reason behind this new escalation between Hezbollah and Israel is because of Israelis who are living in the northern part of Israel. That's why they want to send them to the northern part, and at the same time they want to increase the tensions with Hezbollah because of these people.
I mean, that's the excuse, and it's a real excuse. Netanyahu is feeling serious political pressure domestically from these 60,000 settlers. If you recall, back when the strikes were first coming in out of Hezbollah, the Israelis pretty much abandoned the north in terms of air defense and put it all in the central part to protect it. And the north went, "What are you doing? We exist. We're here." And there's 60,000 settlers who have been compelled to leave their homes because of Hezbollah's actions, who, are suffering. They're, nobody wants to be a internally displaced person, and yet that's what they are. So there's a lot of pressure being put on Netanyahu to be seen as doing something. You can't just allow this the situation to continue. And so he has used this as the excuse, but he needed an excuse. He needed to do something. Notice he didn't initiate this action just with conventional military forces, because that alone would have exposed the emptiness of his rhetoric, because Israel's not prepared to go into full-scale combat with Hezbollah. He initiated by basically nullifying a decades-long intelligence operation to get explosive pagers into the hands of Hezbollah. You know, I believe that such an action was done to disrupt Hezbollah as a precursor to a massive military attack. I mean, because Israel knows Hezbollah's dug in. Hezbollah's got, you know, is ready for them. Hezbollah's been preparing for this. But this pager attack, this walkie-talkie attack, could have created a window of opportunity, a window of chaos, uncertainty, confusion that could have been exploited with lightning attacks, you know, designed to burst through defensive barriers, get in deep into the Latani, disrupt Hezbollah, and maybe, you know, in doing so, put Hezbollah behind the power curve where Hezbollah is reacting to Israel, not Israel reacting to Hezbollah. That's what it was designed to do. He gave it away. He threw it away just to get headlines, to say, oh, look, Netanyahu did something. Israel did something. Oh, they got headlines. Today, it doesn't matter. Hezbollah's adapted. It's over. They threw that away. This tells me that what Netanyahu is doing is more political than military. It's about salvaging his fragile right-wing political coalition. It's about buying time to stave off the domestic attacks that are taking place, political attacks. You know, it wasn't but just a week ago, hundreds of thousands of Israelis are in the streets demanding Netanyahu resign because of the hostage crisis. That hasn't gone away. Now you add to that 60,000 internally displaced persons who are saying, we want to go home. There's a lot of pressure on Netanyahu.
And we had the new president of Iran, Pezeshkian, is now in the United States. He was talking about the conflict in the Middle East between Israel and Hezbollah and about what has happened in Gaza and what is happening right now. He said it seems that the outcome of what he was talking about was the Iran is willing to talk with the United States in order to make some sort of sanity, some sort of understanding on the part of the United States and Iran to bring some sort of sanity to end this conflict in the Middle East. But do you find any sort of understanding on the part of Washington to be willing to talk with Iran in order to bring these tensions down?
Well, absolutely. There's a willingness to talk in the United States, and it transcends political parties. Donald Trump, just on the campaign trail, said he's ready to lift sanctions against Iran and talk to Iran to bring this nonsense to an end, because he says we've lost Iran. We've lost it because of our sanctions, because of our action. We've lost it. We have no ability to interact in a meaningful fashion with Iran. The Biden administration recognizes this as well. And the Iranians are very pragmatic. We've had this conversation before. Everybody is out there saying, you know, death to America. Iran doesn't want to talk. I say, you're hiring a kite. Iran wants to survive and thrive. They don't want to go to war. They're not looking for perpetual war. Yes, there are elements in Iran that exploit passions passionately. Death to America has become, you know, the Iranian version of USA, USA, USA. They just chant it, but they don't mean it. What they want is stability. And, you know, they see an opportunity here to, you know, Iran has facilitated the strategic defeat of Israel. I mean, we can sit here and talk about Israel bombing this, Israel doing that. Let's look at it. Economically, Israel's trashed. The southern port of Eilat's done, shut down. Billions of dollars lost. Their economy is totally on life support. Nobody's investing money in Israel. The whole concept of the Indian Middle East Economic Corridor that's supposed to be the lifeblood for Israel in the region, that's dead in the water. Saudi Arabia says we won't normalize relationships with Israel until there's a Palestinian state and its capital is in Jerusalem. Okay, that means Saudi Arabia is never going to be doing it because the Israeli state as it's currently configured can't do that. Militarily, they can't sustain this. If they do this, they'll collapse sometime next year. There's widespread admission that that is indeed the case. Domestic, in terms of you know, the domestic reality, Israel was meant for people to come there and bask in the sun and live a comfortable life at the expense of the Palestinian people, nonetheless, but live a comfortable life. Israel doesn't exist when people are hiding in bomb shelters, can't go home, can't do their work. Israel ceases to exist at that point in time. And at some point in time, if this continues, Israeli society is going to collapse. You're going to see millions flee. And once enough people flee and the demographics drop to a certain level, the sustainability of a Jewish state called Israel is nil. That's the reality. Iran has achieved this. They've achieved this by supporting Hamas. They've achieved this by supporting Hezbollah, by the Houthi, by the Iraqi militias, by the Syrian militias, by its own presence. This is a strategic victory that Iran has achieved. Now, you don't want to press this issue to the point, though, where Iran starts to pay a detrimental price. Iran, like Russia, is focused on what's going to happen in Kazan, Russia, on October 22nd through 24th, the BRICS summit. Iran is a member of BRICS. This is a multipolar, consensus-driven organization that has surpassed the G7 in terms of geopolitical relevance. Iran's part of that. And being part of it, there's an economic aspect of it too. Iran's also part of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. There's a huge economic component. Iran is focused on being part of this new Eurasian Economic Union. All of this stuff implies, because to succeed economically, you have to have stability. And Iran can't have stability if it's at war with Israel. So, or in a situation where the United States won't talk to it because of the nuclear issues that are outstanding. The United States is ready to make compromises. I believe Iran is ready to not compromise fundamentals, but to enter a negotiation that reduces, not enhances, the prospects of war with either the United States or Israel. This is what a good leader of a nation does. Tries to avoid conflict, find diplomatic off-ramps. I think this is natural. He ran on this platform. Why is anybody surprised? You do know, I mean, you, of course, know how the Iranian system works. Yes, they had an election. I believe that it's a democratic election, more democratic than many places. I don't believe an election was stolen. I think Iranians went to the poll, they voted, and the results are clear. They put in this man who is less conservative than his counterparts was. He ran on a platform, but you know that platform, before he could even put it out there, had to pass the litmus test of the Guardian Council and go up to the Assembly of Experts and get the Supreme Leader saying, okay, if this guy is elected, we're going to have to deal with this platform. And it's a platform we're willing to deal with. So he's not going against the grain here. When he says, I want to have this conversation, it's something that has the approval of the Supreme Leader and the mechanisms of governance in Iran. He's not a free agent. He's not a rogue agent. He's not out there doing things that are incompatible with the theocracy, with the Islamic Republic. He is the Islamic Republic. And so, the fact is, we shouldn't be talking about the Iranian president wanting to do this. He is the face of Iran right now. Iran wants to do this. All of Iran wants to do this because they understand the consequences of war with Israel. They don't want a war with Israel. They don't want a war with America. They want peace. They want stability. And the United States is in a situation right now where it's looking at Netanyahu commit national suicide in Israel and trying to bring the whole world down with him. And so they need to build guardrails here to manage the insanity of Israel and bringing, creating stability with Iran. The mere fact that you can have them talking with Iran reduces the possibility of unforeseen consequences, accidental incidents, because we now, whether it's going to be direct conversations or through an intermediary, I think initially all Iranian-American connectivity is done through an intermediary, but a trusted intermediary who can say, hey, the Iranians called, they don't want a war with Israel. You guys need to put pressure on Israel to stop this. Or, hey, the Americans called, man, what you're doing there is not helpful to this overall objective. Communication. The more people yak, 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 the less people bang, bang, bang. And that's always a good thing.
Yeah, we had a meeting between the foreign minister of Iran and Saudis in New York, and they were hugging, kissing. But we know, Scott, Erdogan was talking about the conflict even between Hezbollah and Israel. Saudis are the same. Iran is thinking the same. They want a better relationship with the United States. And I would argue that Iran definitely wants a better relationship with the United States. But at the end of the day, do you think that the policymakers in Washington consider any sort of relationship between Iran or even a better Middle East with all these countries together, a better relationship with Washington, which would benefit both parties? And how do they see it in terms of the way that Netanyahu is capable of manipulating each and everything related to the Middle East?
Well, first of all, I think we have to recognize that Netanyahu is a self-limiting phenomena, meaning he's not going to be in power forever. He exists right now, but the Biden administration isn't happy with him. I believe Donald Trump understands Netanyahu's the problem, not the solution. That at the end of the day, this crisis will be the end of Netanyahu. How long this takes, we don't know. But you have to, I think all parties agree we have to collectively ride out the Netanyahu era. When Netanyahu is no longer politically relevant, then there will have to be collective decision on how to proceed with Israel. And I think it's sort of good that Iran is willing to talk in an effort to create stability, not instability. I think Iran is not stupid either. They've achieved far too much to throw it away. When I say stability, I'm not talking about letting Israel get off the hook. I think Iran is going to keep as much pressure on Israel as possible, but it has to manage that. It has to manage the pressure, because without the pressure, there's no incentive of the United States to get engaged. But it can't be too much pressure that it distracts Iran from its strategic objective of, being a meaningful part of BRICS, working with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization to make the European Economic Union viable, relevant. So Iran is the only way you do this is through engagement, by talking. If you think you know the outcome of a negotiation when you sit down at the negotiating table, you've never negotiated with somebody, especially on complicated issues. You come in with what you say you want. They come in with what they say you want. The whole process is about communication and reaching a compromise that both sides can agree to. It's not a negotiation. If you come and say my way or the highway, that's a surrender. The other side's surrendering. The United States is not prepared to surrender to Iran, and Iran is not prepared to surrender to the United States. Both sides have their red lines, but what we found is that red lines themselves are flexible as long as they don't compromise underlying principles. I don't think Iran is ever going to give up on the fundamental right of nuclear enrichment. But would Iran be willing to accept certain limitations, restrictions to that? I think the answer is yes. What limitations, restrictions? Iran's not going to commit. You don't give away your hands. You come in and say, this is my red line. And then you get to a point where you almost got everything you want, but this is holding it up. You have to sit back and say, can we bend on this? How far can we bend on this to get the Americans? You find that sweet spot, bam, now you have an agreement. And I think the United States is at the point where it recognizes that the JCPOA was the original Iran nuclear deal. Failed because it wasn't a treaty. Not that treaties matter anymore. Trump just withdrew from a couple of them. But I also think Trump realizes he made mistakes there too. I think Donald Trump has learned. So I don't know who's going to be the president, Trump or Harris. Harris is part of an administration that's is recognizing the limitations of American power. But there's not much that Biden can do right now. He's literally a lame duck president, and he has to tread water until the next president is elected. Biden's hoping it will be Harris. There'll be some sort of continuity of policy. But even when they came in, the Biden administration said that read their national security strategy. The number one goal of the United States of the national security strategy is to preserve and enhance the rules-based international order. But if you've been listening to Biden and Sullivan talk, they all acknowledge that the rules-based, first they said the rules-based international order is under attack. And now they're saying the rules-based international order is getting routed, that they have problems, that it's losing relevance. And how do you have to adjust now to new realities. And it's this adjustment that creates opportunities for new policy, new relationships, new negotiations. And I think Iran is taking advantage of that. The Iranians aren't stupid. Again, Americans, I don't know what most Americans think of Iran. I don't think they hold Iran into high regard. They view Iran as a nation dominated by, religious zealots, these theocrats who all they want to do is whip women and cause problems, but behead men, hang them. Iran's about hanging, not beheading. Saudi Arabia beheads. Of course, that exists. You can find the video clips of the women who violated the hijab rules and they're getting whipped up on. You can find videotapes of the Iranians, hanging guys in the middle of the street. That happens. I've been to Iran. You know what else I found? Some of the most educated people on the planet. I just remember walking through Tehran, downtown Tehran, and I was expecting, the Iranian intelligence services to stalk me. I'm sure they were following me in some form, but it wasn't obvious. I could go anywhere I wanted to. I didn't try to break the rules or bend, but I got up in the morning. I wandered the town, hired a tour coordinator, went out and saw Iran. This guy was stalking me though. And I'm like, what the hell's going on here? And I went into a restaurant and he came in and I'm like, oh man, this can be one of those confrontation things. And he sat down and he introduced himself. He said, "You're Scott Ritter." I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Yeah, I thought I recognized you. Why are you in Iran?" I said, "Well, I'm here to try and, talk about nuclear issues and all that." And he's like, "Oh, no, please don't do that. Because you went to Iraq and you did that. And then the American invaded Iraq. Are you coming here to be the precursor to invade Iran?" But the bottom line is this guy knew everything. And as people heard me talk with him, people just started coming around. And soon the whole restaurant, we're having a little mini seminar there, give and take. People who couldn't speak English were using translators, and I'm answering questions, and it was just very pleasant. They knew everything. They knew everything, unless this was a setup where they secretly had a university class of advanced graduate students. But this wasn't a setup. I picked the restaurant to go into, and it was the people that came around, and they knew everything. The housewives, the man on the street, the old guy drinking tea. They were knowledgeable, educated, locked in. Another time I was at a restaurant and talking with my host, who was a former Revolutionary Guard guy. And he said, "Do you mind if some people join us?" I said, "Okay, bring them over." Well, they were people from the Revolutionary Guard. They were they're in the intelligence corps, and they were the American division of it. And they all came in. They wanted to talk to the American. And I said, "Sure, I don't have any secrets. Let's talk." And we had a long time. These guys were smart. They were locked in, very well informed. And talk about politics. They all admitted under my interrogation that they had committed acts of terrorism and acts of murder. Two of them had been in Europe assassinating Kurds back in the early 80s. Other ones, all the others were involved in the suppression of the MEK, which was very violent. And I said, "So you guys literally are terrorists." They said, "Well, under your definition, yeah, we did what you accused us of doing." He said, "But we've learned. The guys that were in Berlin killing Kurds said, we came back here, and the first thing we did is met with the leadership and say, hey, this death to the West kind of stuff. We don't have to buy into everything they do, prostitution, porn shops, drugs, and all that. No, we don't need that. But the West works. The West functions. I mean, things work over there that don't work here. We need to have a change in our attitude towards this." And you noticed when Rafsanjani was the president, the change took place. Rafsanjani was open to this. And there's always been an element in Iran open to that. And a lot of the impetus for being open to the West came from the Revolutionary Guard, not the liberals in northern Tehran, but from the radicals who were radicalized, who realized that radicalization isn't the solution. Iran is a fascinating country, but the Americans are so unaware of, uneducated about. The same thing with Russia. It's the same concept. We have our prejudices and everything, but the Iranians are a nation that's been around a long time and has great culture, a great sense of history and Iran's place in history. And I think we need to respect the fact that the Iranian leadership, whether we agree with their religious beliefs and their, you know, fundamental, you know, some fundamental issues of their national definition, it's okay. They don't agree with us. You know, it doesn't mean we have to go to war. But they know where they want to go, and they have a good idea of how they're going to get there. And it's going to be through negotiation, not through violence.
Yeah. The president of Iran, Pezeshkian, had an interview with Fareed Zakaria on CNN in which he was responding to how Iran would react, would respond to the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh. Here is what he said.
President of the United States of America.
The government of Israel would, of course, say that the reason they are retaliating against Hezbollah is Hezbollah has been raining rockets in northern Israel, has driven 60, 70,000 people out of their homes. These are men, women, and children. These are civilians. And that Israeli response is a response to that, those Hezbollah rocket attacks.
Do you believe that? In Gaza, the same Israel, how many people have they murdered? More than 41,000 people. What have they done to the Israelis for them to deserve to have their hospitals, their schools, men, women, children, old and young, targeted? How many Israelis were killed in response to which they have killed so many, tens of thousands? Did the children kill anyone? Did the women murder anyone? Is someone who's hospitalized murder anyone? Today at the United Nations, they were saying that 200 United Nations personnel were martyred in this, in that, on that land. So who believes really what Israel says now? If Hezbollah can muster the strength to even, let's assume, rain down thousands of rockets, how many people have they killed? Israel, on the other hand, they commit acts of terror. They go wherever they wish. They attack countries at will. They go wherever they wish and commit assassinations. They've done that for decades. And the greatest international government committing international acts of terror is Israel. Today, through their paramilitary and other organizational personnel, UAVs, aerial bombardments, they're committing these crimes every day. And on the night of my inauguration as the new president of the Islamic Republic of Iran, they came to our capital city and they martyred Ismail Haniyeh. Who does that? Now, these are terrorists, the ones who wish to only defend their land and their dignity and their country. You know, coming up with the appropriate and right numbers is not that big of an effort. Let's see how many have been victims of those who commit the actual terror and how many lives have been lost for defending one's dignity and territorial integrity. Who is it in this framework that has no value for humanity? And the world sees this, the world witnesses this, and the powers are defending this, the powers that are so-called defenders of human rights. This is embarrassing.
You have said that Iran reserves the right to respond in the time, manner, and place of its choosing to the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh. Are you saying that you will for sure respond in some way to that assassination?
If international organizations cannot make this individual sit down and stand down, and they keep allowing someone who unfortunately has the means to commit such atrocities, then naturally we will give the appropriate response.
Yeah. Scott, in your opinion, what was the essence of what he was talking about in terms of the way that we have to find a solution for what's going on with Israel in order to all of this assassination that has been going on for decades?
Well, the first thing is he made it clear that there's no moral equivalence between Israel and Hezbollah. It's not Israel that comes out on top. He made it clear that Israel is the evil, is the bad, is doing the wrong, that you can't, you know, Fareed Zakaria's, you know, question, the implication was that it's Hezbollah that is the root of all problems here. No, Israel is the root of all problems. But the fascinating thing and the big takeaway here is, he didn't say, yes, Iran will strike. We have to strike. We're going to strike at a time and place of our choosing. He didn't say that. What he said is, if the world can't make this man sit down, if you can't bring an end to these policies, then we have no choice but to do something about it. But if Iran is not going to be the destabilizer here, that if stability and peace can be brought into the region, then Iran, you know, isn't going to say, oh yeah, but you know, you killed this guy back, you know, in July, so we have to bomb you. I know everything's going well. I know peace is breaking out all over, but we got to bomb you. That's not what they're saying. They're saying, basically saying, we're willing to draw a line and say what's done is done, if we can get, you know, an outcome that is acceptable. And he didn't put down unrealistic things. He didn't talk about the death to Israel, the elimination of Israel, because I think he knows strategically there's a momentum in that direction that, you know, is going to happen no matter what. He's simply talking about bringing an end to Israel's ongoing genocide against the Gazans and their terrorism of the Lebanese people. And that's probably the most reasonable stance one could expect from Iran at this time.